for the week of April 3rd, 2011.
Whoa. Hey, I thought this was the week of March 27th. Did we enter a time hole?
No.
What happened to the Showbiz Sandbox for March 27th?
Oh, I was actually traveling, so it was very difficult to bring an entire studio with me on the road.
All right.
So should I start over again?
Sure.
For the week of April 3rd, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 98, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. Back in Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And always in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're not always in New York, but you're in New York this week.
That's true. It's been a very disconcerting 2 weeks because 2 weeks ago we didn't do a show. And It was a very stressful week because I had friends calling me saying, I am trying to find the show. Where is it? They kept checking back every day. And also I was worried about the New York Times paywall that was going up that week. And I thought, oh my God, I'm not going to be able to access the New York Times anymore. Because do I go onto the New York Times 20 times a month? I go on it 20 times a day.
Hopefully you don't have to worry about that anymore because at least I can speak for myself. I actually wound up getting a freebie offer from Lincoln, the town car folks owned, I believe, by Ford. But they offered me the rest of the year for free of the New York Times.
Right. So they've had this huge paywall they're putting up, and yet they're panicked somehow. And so I think they say they offered it to a couple hundred thousand of the heaviest users of the New York Times.
200,000 of the New York Times heaviest users. I find it hard to believe that I am among those people.
Well, and I am. I also got the same offer, and I clicked through it. You don't have to see any particular ads, I don't think. I'm not quite sure. Maybe they push in Ford Lincoln ads every time you go onto the site or something. I don't know. But, you know, I appreciate the thing. I was thrilled. You know, for the next 9 months, I don't have to pay. To target the people who were the most likely to pay, however, is a little interesting. If we use it a lot, clearly we're the most likely people to pay for a digital subscription.
Yes, although I don't know why they did that. I know that Lincoln upped their ad budget with the New York Times, their ad buy. So I know that was one reason that they did it. They certainly didn't pay for the free offer, according to the New York Times.
What did the New York Times say?
Just that they didn't pay, that they are spending more money on ads.
That they bumped up their ad buys. So it's the same way. In exchange for buying more ads, they were able to attach themselves to this offer.
Which is really smart because now, you know, I've been telling everybody about it. It was on my Twitter feed and probably on yours. And now everybody was talking about Lincoln.
Yeah. Well, and it also shows how nervous the New York Times is. They saw what happened to the Times of London when they put up their paywall. You know, of course, naturally, the number of people going to the site dropped dramatically, aggressively. And so they want a paywall, but they're also scared about keeping away the people who go to their site all the time.
I suppose you're right. And I continue to go to the site unabated.
Yes. And hopefully some of our listeners got that offer as well.
Yes. And, you know, certainly I would like to apologize to our listeners who we did miss a week last week. I was at CinemaCon, which we will be talking about later in the podcast. During our Inside Baseball segment, the conference between, I guess it's a convention, the largest convention of movie theater owners and movie distributors in the world. It took place last week in Las Vegas. We'll talk about it during Inside Baseball. We'll also debate whether the friggin' culture has changed its mores, specifically in regards to friggin' profanity.
I think it's mores.
Yeah, okay. I'll go with mores. Sounds, you know, kind of flows off the tongue a little better. Amazon launched a music locker service last week, much to the pleasure of every lawyer working for a record label. Netflix continues to dominate the video streaming business, signing new deals with the likes of Fox and possibly Miramax, but not everyone seems to be in love with the service, and some networks and studios are beginning to pull their content. A deal to bring you new episodes of Mad Men was reached last week between the show's creator and AMC, but we'll have to wait until 2012 to see any of them. We'll find out why. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, and given that we're covering 2 weeks worth of news, the show might run a little long, but I can guarantee you, if you listen to the whole show, you will walk away with a full understanding of what is going on in the world of entertainment. And of course, we first turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one film at the box office, much to my astonishment, is the animated film Hop, which grossed $38.1 million this weekend at the box office. If we'd had a show last week, I would have predicted it would flop completely on its opening weekend.
So you thought Hop was going to flop?
I did think Hop would flop, and instead it has popped. The number two film at the box office is Source Code, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. That grossed at a pretty good $15 million. The number three film was Insidious, another opening film that grossed $13.4 million. And number four was the second weekend of Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Roderick Rules, which had a good opening, and this second weekend grossed $10 million. It's at $38 million for a movie that cost $21 million to make. You can be sure there'll be a Wimpy Kid 3. And number five is Limitless, the Bradley Cooper film that grossed $9.4 million. It's at $55 million total. And number six, the Matthew McConaughey film, The Lincoln Lawyer, that's at $39 million total. And number seven, the big flop, Sucker Punch, which had a bad opening last weekend and grossed $6 million this, the biggest drop in 1 week for the entire year so far. That's at $30 million for total for a movie that costs $82 million and must be making Warner Brothers wonder why they have Zack Snyder fronting their Superman film.
I mean, it's unbelievable that this guy gets to continue to make big franchise movies.
At number eight is Rango, which grossed $4.5 million. That's at $113 million in the U.S. and about the same amount overseas. And number nine is Paul, the Alien in America movie, which grossed $4.3 million. And number 10, Battle Los Angeles, which grossed $78 million.
And it only costs, it costs $70 million to make. It's earned, as you just said, $78 million in the U.S. and $100 million overseas.
Right. And that's what a movie has to do to start making money, because obviously they don't get all of it back from the box office. So rule of thumb, I think roughly, is you got to double your budget at least to sort of make money on a film, right?
You know, it depends on the film. These days, there really are no rules, but
that's true. In other news, the PG-13 version of The King's Speech opened up. That didn't do any business at all. It was ridiculous to waste their time and energy. And in limited release, the Paul Giamatti film Win-Win did quite well. And I saw that this week. And I have to say, it's a very good movie by Todd McCarthy, who did The Station Agent and The Visitor, which I did not like. And it's a very nice, strong drama. I recommend it highly.
I liked both of Todd McCarthy's earlier films. I think he's one of the best directors working today. I loved The Station Agent, loved The Visitor, and can't wait to see Win-Win. Now, did you see Source Code or Insidious?
I did see Source Code. I didn't like it at all. I thought it was boring. It's not hateful or terrible. Jake Gyllenhaal is fine in it. It's just a silly thing. Maybe it's an idea for a Twilight Zone episode, 22 minutes at most. It ends poorly and dumbly. You know, it's not the worst thing in the world, but it's no good.
Really? I found it kind of interesting. I thought it was shot really well. And certainly Duncan Jones, who directed Moon previously, directs this film. And it's about an Air Force helicopter pilot, or maybe a Marine helicopter pilot, who is sent into somebody else's being to thwart a terrorist attack.
That's right. He can occupy the last 8 minutes of somebody's mind who's been killed or almost killed in a terrorist attack, and can piece together what was going on to try and track down the real terrorist and get information that can help the cops present the next stage of terrorist attacks. It's kind of hard to describe, and there you go. It takes like half an hour for the film to awkwardly explain, like, okay, here's what's going on. It's one of the problems with the film in my mind.
Well, actually, I thought that was kind of the interesting part about it, that they put the audience in the shoes of the main character. Yeah. The main character didn't know what was going on, nor did we. And we slowly begin to figure it out along with the main character.
Yeah, well, my friend Joe Neumeier at the New York Daily News liked it a lot. He gave it 4 stars out of 5, thought it was a strong, interesting movie. So you're not alone. And it got pretty good reviews overall. I was pretty nonplussed by it. But the one movie I did not go see this weekend was The King's Speech, which, as we said before, they put out in a new PG-13 version. So all those 15-year-old kids who were dying to see the film but their parents wouldn't take them can now finally have the chance.
What did they use instead of the F word? What F word did they use?
They didn't use an F word. They just sort of, I think they dropped the sound is what they did.
Okay.
So you could see his lips move. This is just my hearsay. I don't actually know this, but I believe they dropped the sound. And so you saw his lips moving, but you didn't actually hear him say whatever he was saying.
Right. And we should say that Colin Firth, who plays the former King of England, King Edward, I believe. No, not King Edward.
The then King of England.
The then King of England had a speech impediment, and that's what the movie is about Geoffrey Rush teaching the former King of England.
Everybody knows. It's an Oscar-winning film. Everybody knows.
Right. There's a scene in the film that gets played out for, speech therapy purposes, where Colin Firth is forced to use a profane word, and because of that, it received an R rating. The Weinstein Company was very upset about this, and edited the film so that it received a PG-13 and released that version on April 1st to nobody's delight.
Well, they weren't upset. They just thought they could make a few extra bucks, but it was stupid on every level. There were no 14-year-old kids waiting to see this movie whose parents weren't willing to take them. Yes, it was R-rated, which means if you want to bring your children, you can. But it wasn't the only film that was dealing with cursing this week. Or wasn't the only thing about cursing going on in the last 2 weeks in Hollywood. The Office, for example, had a tie-in to the movie Hop, the animated film that's number one at the box office. It's an Easter film geared towards little kids, really. And they had like an Easter egg hunt during the episode of Office where they were planting clues and help you win a prize or tickets to the movie or I don't know what. It was a tie-in to the film Hop during an episode of The Office. It just so happened that episode of The Office was filled with expletives. People were saying the S word, the F word, and it was getting bleeped out. So you knew what they were saying, though you didn't actually hear it. But I mean, good Lord, you know, that talk about bad timing. I mean, Hop is really geared towards like 8-year-old kids.
You know, the reviews basically said if you are under 12, you will actually find Hop to be a chore to sit through.
If you're over 12.
I apologize. Reverse everything I just said. Yes.
Strike that. Reverse it, as yes. Keith Alder said.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yes, anybody over 12 would be bored out of their mind at Hop. And so they had a tie-in to The Office, which is already weird. And it was an episode that was particularly profanity-laden. But that wasn't it. On American Idol, there was more cursing. American Idol, the number one show in the country and has been for years. One of the contestants last week was the lowest voting getting person. Casey Abrams. And this was 2 weeks ago, actually, in real time. It gets confusing because of when we record and when the show airs. Casey Abrams was dropped by the voters and saved by the judges. And his reaction that he mouthed his words, we didn't actually get to hear him, but you could say he was saying the F word like repeatedly. And he also looked like he was having a heart attack. They kept dropping the audio out again and again because they have a 5-second delay because it's a live show. And so they were saved by that, but you could read his lips and know exactly what he was saying. And then if you go to the music charts, you saw...
Well, the music charts have been kind of, profane for at least a year or more.
Right, thanks to CeeLo's song, Forget You, which has a more colorful title on the album. Pink had a song called Effing Perfect. And in Enrique Iglesias' song, Tonight I'm Loving You, there's also extreme profanity, and that's been in the top 20 or top 10. So at one point, we had 3 songs in the top 10 using the F word. We have the number one show in the country with a top contestant using the F word, just blurting it out. We have The Office bleeping, but clearly having people use the F word. And we have the King's Speech at the box office. So what's going on here?
And Melissa Leo at the Oscars dropping the F-bomb.
That's right. So what's going on here? Is this just a minor trend or is this actually indicative of something?
I think it's indicative of how language, profane language, has become more a norm for our culture.
Yeah, I mean, you watch shows and things that never would have been in prime time in the 70s. Now you see people saying damn and bastard and things like that at 8 o'clock or 8:30 and not even 10 o'clock shows.
Well, look back at Elvis Presley appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show and they cut to a tight shot so that you didn't see his hips moving back and forth because that was too sexually suggestive. And now during the Grammys, you've got Rihanna running around the stage half naked. Times have changed.
Yeah, things always become more permissive, it seems like, or maybe they go a little bit in cycles. But right now, certainly we're in an era where people say, hey, you know what, if you want to watch clean, wholesome programming, you have a million options, 24 hours a day. So if you're going to watch The Office, you know it's really for adults. If you're going to listen to music, you know what songs to listen to. I think people were a little blindsided by American Idol, but there was no outcry. Nobody got upset. They had the 5-second delay, so... You know, trying to decry it and keep it from happening is sort of a losing battle with 200 channels. What are you going to do?
Well, you know, somebody who uses a lot of profane words in his music is Eminem.
And I was going to make the same segue.
Well, yes, segue right into music where I know we're not supposed to point out the segues, but I guess that was, just for those keeping score, a segue. And we received a number of emails from listeners pointing to a New York Times article based on the story we mentioned a couple of weeks ago about how Eminem's lawsuit was, I guess, approved by the Supreme Court over the royalties for music licensing. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about it, Michael?
Well, the Supreme Court declined to take the case, which meant the lower court ruling stood, which means that Eminem was successful in arguing that he deserved a royalty rate for a licensing fee for songs sold digitally rather than a sale rate. If it's a licensing fee, he gets 50% of the royalties. And if it's an actual sale, he gets about 10% or whatever his cut may be. That's very rough numbers. But the fact is he gets a lot more money if what you're selling is considered a license rather than a sale. And as anyone who has ever clicked on their iTunes agreement knows, you're not buying the music. You're licensing the right to listen to the music. So he had a very good case and he won. I wrongly suggested that this didn't have a lot of ramifications because I assumed the record labels had gone back and renegotiated most of their contracts with older artists, but apparently they haven't. And this now means a lot of older artists, especially people from the 80s or earlier, have some real money worth going after, you know, from digital sales. You know, you're Sam and Dave, you've got Soul Man, that sold a lot on iTunes. And guess what? What might have been a couple hundred dollars is now thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars worth of royalties. And that's worth hiring a lawyer to spend a few hours and send a letter and get a check from your record label.
Right. And I'm sure that there's going to be some reverse negotiations on this because it would be billions of dollars flowing through to artists. Now, this 50%, this music licensing, really only applies to digital music and digital sales. It does not apply to, CDs. We should
we're talking about the lawsuit, which we discussed before, was about the royalty rate that you get for a digital transfer of music. If you buy a song or an album on iTunes or Amazon or elsewhere legally, what royalty rate does the artist get? The record label said, well, that's just a sale. It's a physical sale. And the artist says, no, it's not. You're only licensing the music. You don't have to produce anything. Like we've always said, it has to be cheaper to sell music or books digitally because you only create one copy and then you send it out over the wire. And they said, look, you're not producing something or you're not creating a physical product and people don't have the right to own it. They're only licensing it. So it's a license. And therefore, we get a 50% royalty rate. And the record label said, what?
I think it was more like, what?
And of course, other interesting digital music news is circa Amazon. I think you're excited by this.
Well, I'm not necessarily excited by it, but I do think it's a case where the record labels want to have their cake and eat it too. Here you've got them saying, no, Eminem, it's not a license. And then turning around to Amazon and saying, hey, that's a license. And our license doesn't allow you to store music. And what we're talking about here is Amazon beating both Google and Apple. Two companies who we have said in the past are working on a music lockering service or a streaming music service. Amazon comes out of nowhere and launches their own digital music locker last week, not announcing it beforehand, beating Apple and Google to the punch. You can upload your music to this service, and they're giving you about 5 gigabytes of storage for free. And if you buy an album from Amazon's MP3 store, then you get 20 gigabytes of free storage for at least a year. And their slogan, I love it, is buy anywhere, play anywhere, and keep all your music in one place. But the reality is when you buy those digital tracks, those digital albums, you're really only licensing them.
So Amazon says, hey, if you're licensing it, what does it matter if the music is stored on your hard drive on your laptop or on our hard drive in the cloud? What's the difference?
Right. Now, here's the reason that I think Amazon went ahead and did this. They have, of course, a huge backbone regarding internet sites and internet technology, specifically in regards to cloud storage. And they have all of this storage available. So for them, it's as simple as data being stored on a hard drive that is not in your computer or at your home or residence. So the way they look at it is, you know what? This is data and it's being stored by us. It's cloud storage, end of story. It has nothing to do with whether it's music or not. So they see it as legal, though they do want to go out and cut real licensing deals with the record labels in an attempt to make whatever service they're offering a little bit more robust.
Well, because that means they want to step in and go beyond offering just access to the music you buy and offer, subscription services, right?
Right, that's probably true.
Something where you pay a flat $20 a month or $10 or whatever, and you get access to a million of Amazon songs rather than just the ones you bought.
Right, and now, I certainly have gigabytes worth of music. I mean, probably 500 gigabytes worth of music, if not more. 20 gigabytes really isn't a whole heck of a lot.
Do you review music or how did you get so much music?
I've been collecting it since I was a young boy, my friend, and I am now not a young boy anymore.
Well, yeah, so I have 640 gigabytes of music. I have almost no video on this, or photos. We're talking strictly music, 640 gigabytes. If I went to their cloud service and said, okay, I want to put all this music on the cloud and I want to store it there so I can access it anywhere, how much would that cost me? Oh, just $1,000 a year. That's not happening.
Yeah, well, they are certainly going to have to make the cost of storage go down over time, as it always does. But
okay, what does this mean to Google and Apple?
I'm not sure. I think that it will really come down to, at this point, pricing and functionality and features. Which is kind of silly. That's like saying, you know, your product has to be good and it has to be priced correctly. Welcome to Business 101.
But and I still say that for a lot of people, if you own 500 albums, which I think covers 90% of everybody, 90% of the people do not have more than 500 albums in their home. You can keep everything you own on your phone.
Yes.
The idea that you need this cloud service to me still does not quite follow.
Well, for backup purposes, I kind of like it. But I think, you know, let's face it, Amazon will never be allowed onto the Apple Store, or maybe Apple will have to allow an app to be approved in their App Store because
I don't need an app for it. I have hundreds of albums on my Apple iPhone.
Well, what I'm referring to is that Apple and Amazon are now going at it legally because Amazon used the phrase App Store, which is apparently Apple trademarked.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that Apple eventually will have to allow Amazon to create an app for this digital locker service, whether it's needed or not by the end user. And that's because if they don't, then Apple will be – there's some antitrust issue that would creep up if Apple denied Amazon placement in the App Store.
And what's the deal with streaming? That was a new issue as well the last 2 weeks.
Well, of course, everybody believes – I love the fact that all these reports are coming out saying that in the next 5 years, music streaming will really take off. Oh, really? Do you think? I never would have guessed that. Thank you very much.
But they've been talking about it for quite a while.
They have been talking about it for quite a while. And now IFPI, which is kind of like the RIAA, the recording – I know I'm going to scream.
Industry Association of America.
Right. It's the European version of that. They put out a report that the digital sales grew a meager 5.1% last year, and that the U.S. growth was almost flat at 1.2%. And of course, CDs and physical media, the sales have plummeted over the past decade. So, you know, in a way, the music labels are kind of both excited for Google and Spotify and other services like it, but at the same time, they're somewhat terrified and trepidatious because they have no idea what the future holds and what that will do to their business models.
So they're looking forward to people either selling a subscription service where you pay a monthly fee and get access to millions of tracks, and or a radio service like Pandora and Spotify where you just get to play music, but you have ads and things embedded within it or whatever.
Right.
Is that the streaming markets that we're talking about?
That's exactly right. And the problem with streaming for the record companies is that the royalties are much, much lower. So you don't get as much money from streaming a song as you do from buying it, whether it's digital or physical. I guess the fear is that if streaming does become as popular as everybody suspects, that artists and labels really aren't prepared for, as one person put it, quote, the days when their margins from downloads are obliterated.
Now, everybody talks about streaming and subscription services coming to the U.S. and Europe and how they're going to work. But in fact, I saw a study that talked about where streaming could really take off quickly is emerging markets. China and India in particular are ripe for the service because people don't have the space or funds for a stereo system or hundreds of CDs and a laptop and an iPod and a car radio and all that. But everybody has a phone and they use their phone to do business. They use their phone to buy things with you know, the little credit card stuff embedded. They can use phone to carry music around. And if they can stream it and use their phone to give them music and access to music, that can give them a huge leg into a market where there's a lot of bootlegging and pirating and they don't have a very good foothold. And that could be a huge advantage for them.
Yeah, I guess what you're saying is make it easy, make it affordable, and people will stop pirating.
That's right.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking of pirating, I mean, if you look at what one of the big complaints that people have against Amazon, it's that you're allowed to rip your own CDs that you have lying around your house, or like myself, in the garage, and you can upload them to Amazon. So a lot of folks are saying, well, this is a pirate's dream.
I'm not sure why, because they have access to the music anyway. It doesn't give them anything new that they don't have already. You know, they have access to their music. The fact that they can store it somewhere else is a different service. It has nothing to do with whether you created the music yourself, bought it legally, or borrowed it from your friend. People shouldn't steal music, but that's got nothing to do with this service.
Right. Well, now, speaking of stealing music, just a little aside, and I know we're going to be talking a little bit about this later during Big Deal or Big Whoop, but over the past 2 weeks, the music industry has said that LimeWire, the BitTorrent application, the peer-to-peer application, owes them $75 trillion, which is such a staggering number that it is more than the music industry has earned in total since the invention of Edison's phonograph.
Did they? Is that include damages?
No, I think they're saying that basically what the pirated material was worth $75 trillion, which everybody kind of laughs at and goes, you're a moron if you believe that.
Was that just something they said, or have they filed lawsuits, or what's going on?
I think that it's just something they said in the midst of their lawsuit against LimeWire.
Oh, okay.
And the judge kind of, I think, still hasn't stopped laughing. So that there's no ruling yet because the judge has the hiccups at this point, can't stop laughing.
Well, and it didn't come to a lawsuit, but of course, in the world of television, in the last 2 weeks, we've had endless stories about Mad Men, the AMC TV series, which has won Best Drama for a couple years in a row, and the tussles and back and forth between the creator, Matt Weiner, and the studio and the people who air the show, which are AMC.
And Lionsgate. Lionsgate produces it. AMC airs it.
That's right. We would have had a story last week saying, oh, they can't come to an agreement. And this week we have a story saying they've come to an agreement.
Yes. Well, I have to say, running around Las Vegas, at Caesar's Palace last week at this conference, CinemaCon, my BlackBerry did not stop buzzing with the alerts from the Hollywood Reporter and the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times about this story. It drove me insane.
Well, and there's a big reason. I mean, it's a big show, not in ratings, not in ad sales, but it's a big show culturally and as far as what it means to AMC and the channel and Lionsgate and all that. Lionsgate, you know, they're talking could make $100 million eventually on DVD sales of the show.
DVD sales alone.
Right.
Now, and they already get paid $3 million an episode from AMC just to produce the thing.
Right. And the problem is last year, AMC only made $2 million in ad sales per episode. So they were losing $1 million an episode. Now, granted, this is the show that put them on the map. Now, because of this show, they have Breaking Bad, which also is not a big seller. And they have The Walking Dead, which actually is a relatively big hit for them. And, you know, they're a channel that people actually talk about now, whereas before they were known for Remember When and reruns of old movies.
Right. And, you know, look at it. In 2006, AMC's ad revenue before Mad Men ever aired was $139.3 million. And according to SNL Kagan, which is an industry consulting firm, last year's AMC ad revenue, they took in $245.6 million.
Yeah, but I'd like to know how much they've increased their costs. Because now they have three or four or five or six shows that they are paying money for. They're launching another show this week called The Killing. They have shows that have come and flopped like Rubicon. So they're spending a lot of money they weren't spending before. You know, it doesn't cost a lot to license 1942 musicals starring Mickey Rooney.
What if they starred Cary Grant?
Then it costs a lot of money.
A little bit more money? Okay.
So basically, there were all sorts of back and forth. The basic final deal is that, yes, they're going to slightly shorten the episodes by a couple minutes.
The premiere, only the ones in the middle, the premiere and the end.
The vast majority of the episodes. So the premiere and the season finale will be expanded length, of about 47 minutes. But the regular episodes will be 45 minutes, and they'll make the longer version available online and, of course, on DVD down the road.
Right, and that was one of the big sticking points for Matthew Weiner, who is the show's producer and head writer, a guy who also was the creator of The Sopranos.
No, he was not the creator.
He worked on The Sopranos. Yes, thank you. So, I mean, getting rid of him, they were going to like move forward without him because his contract expired at the end of, I guess like 2 or 3 months ago, and they were just going to move forward without him, which seems somewhat sacrilegious.
They wanted to cut too well. They did on people have done it on Hill Street Blues, which seemed insane, and the show suffered for it. But it happens all the time, surprisingly more than you would think. You know, established, and they think we don't need them.
Well, that was one sticking point: the show length, as was the number of cast members. They wanted to cut a few cast members to lower the budgets. They also wanted to introduce more product placement.
It seems like a perfect thing for Mad Men.
I know.
Product placement seems like the easiest thing in the world to do.
I couldn't agree more. Not only that, they get to do product placement for tobacco companies.
Yeah, so I'm not quite sure why Matthew, I don't know what they wanted to do that he objected to, but it seems like, how hard can it be? It's an ad show.
Yeah, and you know, he was very vocal, Matthew Weiner, that is, about the negotiations and where they stood and the ongoing process. He continued to talk to the press. In the middle of the week, I guess AMC said that, everything was being held up because he wanted more money.
He's a greedy bastard.
Right. And he then told Vulture, after everything was closed and the deal was done, he says, look, it was an education for me, but I get to make the show the way I want to, and that's all that matters. It was never about the money.
Yeah, and he said he doesn't make what does he make? $30 million over the next three seasons, which is practically $1 million an episode, which frankly is not that much money. I mean, it's not some exorbitant amount.
Not for somebody in his shoes, no.
Yeah, exactly. And so them trying to paint him as the bad guy was kind of obnoxious. Plus, there's a little story behind the story, as people love to say. As they complain about the show and how much it costs, the company that does it, Rainbow Media, which owns AMC as well as WE and IFC and Sundance, is about to launch an initial public offering. And of course, all the top execs and people are going to have a huge payday. And one big reason that they're able to do the IPO, Mad Men. That's the show that put them on the map.
Well, he kind of, I have to say, Weiner, when talking to the Vulture, was kind of scathing in a way, because he says, you know, first off, the show doesn't come back until early 2012 because nobody did anything to get this year's episodes onto the air.
Well, you know, they I think they purposely delayed because they have pushed Breaking Bad, another show of theirs, which has won Best Actor several years in a row, and rightly so. Breaking Bad is a great show. You should watch it on DVD. That show moved from its early winter launch to summer. And I think they didn't want it in summer. You know, they've moved Mad Men to spring and Breaking Bad to summer, and they have The Walking Dead in the fall. So I think because they moved Mad Men forward, they wanted to have, you know, a staggered year where you have Mad Men in March, Breaking Bad in the summer, and The Walking Dead in October. So I think that was their plan all along.
Well, Weiner says that AMC didn't even approach him regarding negotiations until 3 weeks ago, which was after his contract had already expired. He didn't know that the show wasn't coming back until 2012, until he went to lunch with them in the middle of March. They didn't even, like, notify him. The head of AMC still has not spoken to Weiner.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, I think, bad business, frankly.
Yeah, there's no reason. I mean, even if you're going to have a tough negotiation, there's no reason not to be open and transparent and maintain a good relationship with the guy creating the show that gets you to win the Emmy every year.
Well, now, speaking of tough negotiations and controversy, a couple weeks ago, we talked about the Time Warner iPad app, which allowed you to stream live television, at least for certain channels and certain networks, right onto your iPad. And I downloaded it. 300,000 other folks downloaded it. I have not really used it that much since because you can only use it in your home. Well, a couple of networks actually had some issues with that. They launched with, Time Warner launched with 32 channels, and I guess Fox, Viacom, and the Discovery networks, they wanted their channels pulled.
Right, so that means Animal Planet, BET, Comedy Central, Discovery, FX, MTV, National Geographic, Nickelodeon, Spike, VH1. Those are some of the channels that got pulled from the from this app.
And those are big channels, actually.
Oh, sure. Of course.
But then last week, Time Warner came back and said, hey, you know, we're actually going to add Disney, NBC Universal, Turner, A&E Television Networks, CNN, CNBC, C-SPAN. So they added all of these different, they added the Food Network. Actually, the Food Network was always there. So they added a whole bunch of new networks, though ones that are not as popular as the ones which were pulled.
But why did they? Well, some are. You know, Bravo and CNN. CNN and New York One are definitely, that's a local New York channel. Those are definitely big channels that people would want to watch on this iPad app. But I wonder why those people came on board.
Some are Time Warner people. Some are owned by other MSOs and cable operators. So
the fallout is that some people said, hey, pull our stuff off this app. And some other people said, hey, we're happy to be on it. But they haven't resolved anything as far as whether it's legal or not yet, have they?
No, that's really the true issue here is that everybody believes, well, Time Warner believes that what they're doing is legal. They are providing something that they have licensed to somebody who is paying for it. And I have to agree with that. I pay for cable. So whether I watch it on a television or watch it on a slab of cement does not matter.
But does it matter if you're in your home or if you're traveling on the highway or in a plane?
If I've paid my cable bill, then I don't think it should.
I agree completely. It'll be interesting to see whether they have a good legal argument and whether this is, in fact, a new service. People have the ability to do it now with Slingbox and other things. Why shouldn't they be able to watch their local cable programming that they pay for on an iPad in Paris?
Well, part of the problem, of course, is that if you start handing out your username and password, that person in Paris is not allowed to watch.
Only one person can do it at a time.
Yes, that is true. However, if you give out your, while you're asleep here in the United States, if your friend in Paris is watching Mad Men on AMC, well, that it's not licensed, that that content is not licensed that way.
That's true, and that would happen, and that's the worst-case scenario. And you know what? Relax, because basically, if people are clamoring to watch your stuff and someone's paying for it, and they're willing to say for 4 hours a day while I can watch my sister's television in London, they should say, you know what? That's all right.
And you can't fast-forward through commercials on these things. You have to watch the commercials.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's live television. So, and frankly, Time Warner was the only iPad app that had live television until the middle of last week when Cablevision started to make their app available to mobile devices. It has 300 cable channels and 2,000 VOD titles.
Well, yeah, and I think people are clamoring to watch BBC programming and not have to wait 6 months or a year to see it in America. You know what? Make it available. Let them do it. Make them pay, but let it happen. People are going to want to do it one way or another. Why you want to stymie? I understand, you know, you want licensing around the world and you want to bring it to PBS, but you know what? If there's a couple hundred thousand people who have read about a TV show in the UK and they want to watch it right now, you should be in the business of helping them do that rather than saying no and fighting them and making it impossible for them and miserable just so that a year from now you can launch it on PBS. You know what? Those people are going to talk it up if it's any good. So relax.
Well, then what do you think Paramount and – well, I guess Paramount and Fox cut a deal with Netflix, but Showtime and Starz are kind of trying to back out of their deal with Netflix. What do you think Showtime and Starz should be doing? Because last week they decided – to delay some of their programming to Netflix's streaming service. Starz will impose a 90-day delay for the availability of all their original series, including Camelot. And Showtime, well, I guess that's Showtime that has Camelot, right?
No. Showtime is on Starz.
Ah, okay. I mean, all of their series, which I guess include Dexter, will not appear on Netflix. They will keep past years episodes available.
Okay, you're confusing the hell out of me. Basically, we've switched from the Time Warner app to Netflix.
Yes.
We're cutting deals and not cutting deals, and people are putting stuff on Netflix and taking it off. A lot of things happened in the last 2 weeks related to Netflix. Paramount is allowing Netflix to put some of their stuff online in Canada and stream it. Fox and Netflix expanded their stuff, and they've added Glee to the streaming service so you can watch new episodes of Glee.
And the first two seasons of Sons of Anarchy, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I have those on DVD. I haven't watched them yet, but I've heard a lot of really good things about it. I'm looking forward to watching it. What happened with Miramax?
Miramax, they're still in talks with, but Miramax, you know, they're kind of whores in a way. They're talking to Google, Hulu, and all these digital distributors trying to get as much money as they possibly can from their 700 film library.
Because that's what matters. It's the content. And Netflix lost some Showtime content because, like HBO, Showtime wants people to come to their site and say, okay, I'm paying for a Showtime subscription of $12 a month. What have you done for me lately? Well, HBO said, guess what? We'll give you access to everything we've ever done, HBO on the go. And I think that's a pretty good value-added thing.
I think it's called HBO Go.
HBO Go, you're right. And Showtime says, hey, let's do the same thing. And basically right. They're saying, why let Netflix do it? If we're getting people to subscribe to Showtime, they should have the bonus of being able to watch our entire library of stuff.
Right. They have something called Showtime Anytime. And they want to offer that to subscribers. And if it's already available to Netflix subscribers, you don't have to subscribe to Showtime. Then what's the point in subscribing to Showtime?
And, you know, we've talked a lot about Windows, and we'll be doing more of that when we get to video on demand in the Inside Baseball. But as you say, Starz has tightened their Netflix windows, and they're saying, all right, never mind. We're going to make you wait 90 days before you can put something on Netflix because we want people to watch our channel and our reruns on our website.
That is exactly right. Well, meanwhile, CBS, which owns Showtime, it cut a deal with Netflix, so go figure. So, you know, it's...
But the big thing is that a lot of people have a lot of product on Netflix, and that's a major player right now. They're starting original programming, and it's even affecting colleges. I know Ohio University has a problem because their students are logged on all the time streaming TV shows. And guess what? That eats up a lot of bandwidth. You can't spend too much time reading up on Aeschylus when other students in your class are watching Camelot on streaming video.
Wait, Aeschylus, reading up on it, I can't even spell it. So, you know, Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, they have 32,000 students, and they have lowered their throughput, their internet throughput, to 5 megabits per second, which is kind of low, because they found that 60% of their bandwidth was being used for entertainment streaming, including 28% for Netflix content and 12% for Flash video, like on YouTube. And others included like 25% for internet browsing and 7% for file sharing. So it's kind of funny. But really, it all boils down to the content owners believe that the content is king, rather, and that's where all the value is, rather than in the distribution method. But time will tell whether the distribution method is more important than the content itself.
Well, the tension is, you know, people want to watch programming, and they don't want to have to go to 800 different sites in order to watch an HBO show, a Showtime show, an MTV show, a Fox show, an FX show. It gets confusing when they can go to one or two sites and see almost everything, like Netflix or Hulu. then it's easier. You know,
people do you think the entertainment companies are overvaluing the content then?
No, I think the content's really important, but I think how they make it available, they're not going to make the most of that content if they block it off too much.
And so do you think all these different services, I guess you just said it, you find that you believe that it will confuse the consumers?
Yeah, if you make it too hard, if everybody holds on to their own little thing and they don't know where to go to find something, or they have to go to 800 different sites to do it, that's not going to make a very happy user experience. I think if you're going to the whole library of HBO, okay, that makes sense to go to HBO. But if you want to watch a recent episode of something and you go to Hulu and you go to Netflix and you can't find it, you might get a little confused.
Well, certainly this whole pushback on Netflix may have a little something to do with the fact that they're going into original programming on their own, as we talked about 2 weeks ago with House of Cards, an original series that will be directed by David Fincher and starring Kevin Spacey. They themselves are becoming a little bit more like a cable network, and that is, I'm referring to Netflix.
That's true. I mean, well, they just see them as a big player. They realize with everybody putting stuff through Netflix and Hulu that these two sites, they got to really think about, why are we giving this to them? How much value are we getting for it? Is it worth it for me to offer it to them, or should I hold it onto it myself?
Well, you know, speaking of big players, Spotify is a huge player in Europe, and we've talked about this company numerous times. It's a music streaming service that has access to millions and millions of songs that you can pay to, you can subscribe to.
And they have a million users in Europe.
In Europe, and they're trying to come to the U.S., and it's been very difficult for them, so much so that TechCrunch Europe kind of punked them on April Fools. They broke a news story that Spotify had come to the conclusion that the only way it could fund a U.S. launch was if they shut down their entire U.K. operation. They then reported on a fake email, which was sent to Spotify users by CEO Daniel Ek, who told them that while he's sorry for the inconvenience, a U.S. launch is simply more important than their continued use of the service. And at this point, TechCrunch finally, you know, gave the prank away. The CEO went on to offer paid subscribers a t-shirt and a hat, and the pride of knowing that they helped launch Spotify in the U.S. And I love the final paragraph. The TechCrunch quotes Sean Parker, who said, "Europe isn't cool. You know what's cool? America."
Now all our European listeners hate us.
Well, no, you know what that's in reference to. Sean Parker, that's Sean Parker's line in The Social Network.
Oh, okay.
He says, $1 million isn't cool. You know what's cool? $1 billion.
There you go.
You know, I find that jokes are much funnier if you don't have to explain them.
It's often true. But the online does create a lot of opportunities for pranks.
Yeah, it also creates a lot of opportunity for writers such as yourself. You write for the Huffington Post.
That's true. And a week and a half ago, I got a survey from Huffington Post. They sent out apparently to all their bloggers. I'm not sure if it's to every single one of anybody who's ever contributed to them or just their heavy users or what, but they sent out a survey asking for feedback. You were going to remain anonymous. They wanted to get info on your experience with the site and where you come from. And I think this obviously comes about because of some sensitivity they have over bloggers complaining that, oh, you sold the site for $300 million. Why are we working for free? And all that sort of attitude, which I've talked about before. But it is kind of interesting, and I thought people might be interested to know what they were asking the bloggers, what they wanted to find out from us, and what they were saying.
So one of the questions is, in the past 12 months, has internet distribution helped you financially? Do you strongly agree or disagree?
Yeah, it was sort of a weird question. I'm not sure what they mean by internet distribution, but if they mean the web rather than newspapers and magazines, the fact is it's strongly hurt me financially. So I would say I disagree, because it certainly hasn't helped me, because newspapers and magazines are going bankrupt all over the place.
I love the fact that they put at question 11, which probably should have been question number one. Do you feel you should receive part of the $315 million AOL used to purchase the Huffington Post?
Yes, that was sort of the kicker. They started off with, like, how often do you blog? What's your sex? What's your age? Did you go to college? You know, do you work for a traditional outlet? You know, if we were going to pay people, what would you think would be fair? A flat rate per piece? Do you think you should get a cut based on web traffic? Do you think you should get a salary? What do you think you should get? Who helps the site more, bloggers or editors, blah, blah, blah. Then they got to the gist of it. Do you think you deserve a cut of the pie?
Yeah, and since the merger, are you likely to blog more, the same, or less?
And I'm sure that's a good question, because I'm sure people said, well, you know, they suddenly feel stupid I don't want to go into how HuffPost works or why it exists or why anybody would want to contribute. But, you know, do I deserve a cut of the $350 million? Of course not. I didn't launch Huffington Post. I have nothing to do with it. I have no legal link to them. They don't need me any more than I need them, in a sense. You know, I only post because I think it's to my advantage. And, you know, I didn't take the risk to launch the site. Of course I don't deserve a cut of it.
Well, much like David Wilde, who is a Rolling Stone contributing editor, and he writes the Grammy Show and the Academy Awards and the American Country Music Awards, you both contribute to the Huffington Post, but you contribute for very specific reasons and reasons that actually help you out in the long run.
Well, they don't help me out necessarily, but they keep me viable. You know, newspapers and magazines are going bankrupt. Newspapers have cut way back on their freelancer use. When I pitch to the LA Times and try to get an article, they can look at my stuff and say, oh, I've got recent stuff from the last year, not 5 years ago, where they go, what's this guy been doing?
Well, you've had some recent stories in the Los Angeles Times, in fact.
Well, yes, I have. And like I said, you know, if I'm pitching something to an editor, I got my way in there. I just started like a year ago. When they look at my work, if they'd seen for the last 4 years I hadn't done much of anything, they might not have used me. But
right.
Because they saw active clips. So I've been to Cannes, I cover Broadway, I've done this, I've interviewed this person and that person. I look legitimate.
Now, speaking of Broadway, you just bought? I don't know, whatever the word
is. I brought it up.
You brought it up. And so let's move on to theater, because I want to know, did you see In the Heights and did you like it? I know you probably saw it, but did you like it?
I did not see it. It's a musical created by Lin-Manuel Miranda. I did not see the show. It came to Broadway when I wasn't around. It's sort of it's a very traditional Broadway show, actually, though it has sort of a Latin and hip hop flair to it. And it's the story of a young guy, you know, making his way in the city. It won the Tony for Best Musical, and they were going to turn it into a movie.
Right. Directed by Kenny Ortega. And we should say, when you weren't around New York City, not that it was done 50 years ago or 60 years ago.
Oh, yeah. No. It just closed on Broadway just recently. It was on Broadway for a couple of years, had a very good run.
I'm not quite sure how I've seen this musical on Broadway and you haven't, but I did see it and it's a feel-good show. And I guess Universal decided, not so feel-good. We won't make it.
I'm surprised the budget is $37 million, which sounds about right for this, because a musical is complex and complicated to do. And $37 million is not cheap, but it's by no means expensive. So it seems about the right bet to place on this movie. You know, it's got a good name, it's got a good pedigree. And I guess the problem for them was that they thought they would be able to cast some big Latino stars in smaller roles, and that didn't work out, and they got worried about the movie.
Right, and it's kind of hard to do that show without Lin-Manuel Miranda. I mean, he is the whole show.
Well, he's going to be in it, isn't he?
Yes. And but they're saying, do we pin $37 million on a name and face nobody knows?
Yeah, well, no, that wouldn't be smart. I don't think that was the sticking point. They were always going to make the movie with him as the lead, so...
Will you go to London to see David Mamet's new play, The Anarchist? Going to be bowing this fall.
Well, I'm going to be in London in May before and after Cannes, so I won't be able to catch this play unless I go back. I don't think that'll happen this year, but I do go back to London regularly. So he's had a number of plays open in London, so that's not unusual.
Including Glengarry Glen Ross, which opened in 1983.
That does surprise me. I didn't know that. That's news.
Well, now, you were very dubious or... skeptical, I guess would be a much better word, on how the Addams Family would fare once Nathan Lane left. And now Bebe Neuwirth is leaving. And so they played, I guess, what was the name of... Bebe Neuwirth was playing Morticia Addams, but what was Nathan Lane playing? Mr. Addams, the husband. But Brooke Shields is going to be stepping in for Bebe Neuwirth to play Morticia.
And it's not her first time. She's been... she was on Broadway in Grease, a show that sort of, you know... trundled in stars into different roles constantly. That's how they kept the show going. Nathan Lane played Gomez, of course, and big Broadway draw. And Bebe Neuwirth is a big Broadway star. And the show got poor reviews, but it is a brand name. It's run for quite a while with them in the leads. And now they're hoping that the show will keep going. You know, Roger Reese, I think, is taking over the Nathan Lane role, and Brooke Shields will be in the Morticia. So I think this sort of stunt casting, not to cast aspersions on the actors, but this idea of bringing in a big name to put in the role means that they think they need to juice it up and, you know, keep it going by being able to say, see Brooke Shields in the Addams Family. And then 6 months from now, they'll say, see Dolly Parton or, you know, whatever in the Addams Family.
Well, you said it wasn't the first time for Brooke Shields. It's the first time she's going to be in the Addams Family, but she, you know, took over the Roxy Hart role in Chicago on Broadway. She took over a role in Cabaret and a role in Grease, as you mentioned. But she is a big name, and so is John Mellencamp and Stephen King, who are two names you don't usually associate with theater productions. However, They are collaborating on a theater production called Ghost Brothers of Darkland County, which is finally going to get a debut. I guess they've been working on it for several years. It turns out, listen to this lineup. Mellencamp is writing the lyrics. The book is by Stephen King. And the music is by T-Bone Burnett. How could you go wrong?
No, that's not true. The songs are by John Mellencamp. T-Bone Burnett is the musical director, I think.
Okay, you're right.
That's okay, yes. But they've been working on this for a long time. I think they've done some workshop productions, but now they're doing a proper launch in Atlanta. So that'll be fun, and hopefully it'll make its way to Broadway.
Yes, they say it's been 11 years in the making, and it's described as a Southern Gothic work based on a true story that Mr. Mellencamp wanted to fashion into kind of a Tennessee Williams feeling musical.
And a different show that took about 11 days to put together rather than 11 years.
I apologize. I have to say, I don't think it took 11 days. I think it took more like 11 minutes.
It's true. We're talking about the Charlie Sheen show, which is a comedy tour, I guess. And it bizarrely sold out in a number of cities when he announced the tour. And it debuted in Detroit last week.
Poorly.
And was a disaster. He barely showed up. People were annoyed. They got bored. It was just slapdash and lame. He wasn't very funny. It ended in under an hour, I think. And he said something like, "Too bad, suckers, I already got your money."
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what I found interesting about this, why we're discussing it. The New York Times sent A.O. Scott, one of their top critics, to Detroit to cover the opening of this show. Not only is that silly, I mean, why shouldn't it be some cub reporter in
Chicago? Why would they send Tony Scott to Detroit to cover this when, you know, Tony Scott is not a theater critic. He is a film critic and a very good one. But does he do theater now?
Well, I don't think anybody should be limited. I like to do books, film, theater, music, television. So that's not my objection. My objection is to the Times wasting time and money to presumably fly the guy out in first class, put him up in a hotel so he can cover the Charlie Sheen show, which, by the way, plays in New York this weekend at Radio City Music Hall. So it's like, really? You had to be there in Detroit for that first special moment? You know, this isn't, you know, the producers opening out of town and the buzz is great. It's just a train wreck of a thing. And to waste time and energy when, you know, newspapers are tightening their budget, this is how they decide to spend their money.
Well, it's a 70-minute show that was mostly video clips. Sheen got booed off stage the next night, which was Sunday, in Chicago. He changed up the format of the show and turned it more into kind of like a talk show. So he was interviewed by someone about his life and all of his goings on.
And he got a standing ovation at the end.
Yes.
So it may not be a disaster. I mean, I assumed he would be taking questions all the time. I think he took a few in Detroit. Somebody said, "Hey, tell us some AA stories." That didn't go over so well with Charlie.
So much so he got booed off stage.
Yeah.
But so I'm confused. Do you think Charlie Sheen's, I guess, live act is a big deal?
Well, I think it's a big deal. He's appearing on sketches in a Drew Carey show launching on cable. He's touring the country, selling out shows, and, you know, reviews good or bad, he's doing it, and he's adjusted and may hopefully turn it into a success. I mean, I don't really care, but, you know, good for him. To argue that he's incapable of doing his sitcom when all this is going on is a big deal for him because it makes CBS look stupid.
Well, speaking of big deals, that brings us right into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week, or in this case, the past 2 weeks, and decide whether they are a big deal or whether anyone should care about them. Our first story this week, which newspaper has the biggest local readership? The Poynter Institute wanted to know a simple question. Which newspaper has the biggest audience in its area when you combine online and print? They excluded national newspapers like USA Today and the Wall Street Journal, and they ignored all the readership for the New York Times, LA Times, and the like from around the world, and instead counted only readers that were local. The result? Well, the newspaper with the biggest combined readership is the New York Daily News, with 4.5 million readers, followed by the Los Angeles Times at 4.4 million and the New York Times at 4.1 million. Rounding out the top five and the only other papers to reach more than 3 million are the New York Post at 3.4 million and the Chicago Tribune at 3 million. Let the bragging rights begin. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It is a big deal. I think local readership matters a lot, especially to advertisers. And I think it's a very important metric to look at. You know, it's great that the New York Times has readers in Zimbabwe, but do you care if you're an advertiser?
Probably not, actually. Those probably get discounted.
Exactly.
Although, actually, advertising networks do serve up local advertising. So when you're in the UK and you're reading the New York Times, you get UK ads. At least I do.
Right. So worldwide reach is important and good, but it's a very nice, interesting thing to say, hey, who's the big kahunes? Who's the big guy in this market?
Right. I mean, you still have to be an influencer in your own market. Speaking of influence, how about Tyler Perry? He's got a lot of influence. And one of the least shocking developments in Hollywood, Lionsgate has re-upped its deal with filmmaker Tyler Perry. The creative force behind the Madea franchise, Perry is perhaps the safest bet in Hollywood, turning out a string of modestly budgeted movies that always, always make their money back and often deliver very strong profits. His brand has been extended into TV with two sitcoms, and Perry shows no signs of slowing down from his 2 to 3 movies a year pace. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop because it was such a no-brainer. Tyler Perry is money in the bank. I'd make the deal with him.
Yeah, he was at CinemaCon last week, actually. And very funny. I mean, he talked about how he used to shine Oprah Winfrey's shoes.
Really?
Yeah, when he was working at a hotel. And now, you know, Oprah Winfrey has him on a show.
That's funny.
Not so fast, Google. The information giant has been digitizing every out-of-print book it can get its dirty little hands on and came up with a deal that many felt gave it too much control over such titles now and into the future. A judge just ruled that the deal Google arranged with publishers is no good. This comes more than a year after the settlement was reached. Too many authors actively asked to not be a part of the settlement, more than 6,000 in fact. Too many groups of various types raised objections, and yet it can all be solved with one simple change to the agreement. Make it opt-in instead of the current opt-out. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal. I love opt-in. Of course, we should champion that whenever we can. This has encouraged a lot of people to look at creating a national digital library for works that have been orphaned, you know, to do it in a nonprofit way where a private company doesn't get control of that information. That's very difficult to do, of course. Hopefully a different deal can be worked out with Google and publishers. Google doesn't think it's worth their while if they have to have people opt in. Giving away the store to a company that's digitizing every book in the world didn't seem like a very smart thing to do.
Well, Google did actually start this as a way to gather knowledge. They did not begin it as a way to hoard all these books. Their original intent was kind of beneficial. I think it's definitely turned into kind of a big cluster. Well, we still don't use those words here, do we?
No, we don't. But it's not evil to digitize every book in the world. And they've sitting on 50 million books, and they can. People are like, hey, why not donate it to this public work thing that we're doing? Google's like, we'll get back to you on that. But I think it'll work out for the best in the end. I don't think this was a very good deal.
MySpace is hurting. The once mighty internet site lost 10 million users in just 1 month. That's right. The number of internet users on MySpace fell from 73 million to 63 million from January to February of this year. A Wall Street Journal report stated advertisers are leaving the site in droves, and one analyst said they doubted MySpace would still be around by the end of the year. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I'm not quite sure what happened in January that 10 million people stepped away. And 63 million is still a lot, but I guess if that's a trend, they're in trouble. You know, they got to staunch the bleeding. I still go there all the time whenever I'm looking up an act. That's where I often find their music streaming very easily. And I go there all the time to play 3 or 4 tracks from an artist to see if I want to hear the whole album.
They really missed the boat on their whole how powerful and how strong they were in music.
Yeah.
The March Madness college basketball tournament proved a big hit in the ratings. People watched it avidly on CBS, a number of different cable channels, and their iPhones, and iPads, and other digital devices. CBS decided to allow full and easy access to streaming video of the games, and naturally many people took advantage of that at work. But lots of people watched the games on their iPhones and iPads as well, since a third of the streams are watched on those Apple products, and a third of the commercials, I would imagine, as well. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, like we've been saying. Let people watch your content in as many ways as possible. Let them decide how they want to consume it. You'll make money somehow.
The Book of Mormon opens to rave reviews. That is what is known as an understatement. In fact, the Broadway musical by the guys from South Park received the most lavish praise for any show since The Producers starring Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane back in April of 2001, a decade ago almost to the day. Its reception was the polar opposite of the preview coverage of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. That show was called one of the worst musicals in Broadway history. The Book of Mormon has been dubbed one of the best. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's totally a big deal. I can't remember a show getting this much attention and press and rave reviews since The Producers, like we mentioned back in 2001. Broadway needs big hits every year or two to revitalize itself. You know, a long-running smash that gets people excited. And you look back and you see every few years it happens. Mamma Mia came out in 2001, Wicked in 2003, Jersey Boys in 2005, Mary Poppins in 2006, and Billy Elliot in 2008. And it's been a few years since we've had one that looks like it could run for 5 or 10 years. And of course, 5 years is a lifetime for a Broadway show. And we still need to see how the show works for the tourists down the road, because it is a little scandalous. But like Avenue Q, this could be a really long-running hit.
Random House, one of the biggest publishers in the world, had a big 2010, hitting $2.57 billion in the U.S. market. The big title? This series of books by Stieg Larsson, led by The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which sold a combined 13 million copies. The big Hollywood movie adaptation of that book hasn't even been released yet. Ebooks grew by 250%, and digital sales, including all the ebooks and audio, accounted for 10% of all sales. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, to think that ebooks and audio are already 10% of books and they're barely getting going. It seems more and more like half the business is going to be ebooks in just a few years.
The music industry is in such a slump, people aren't even stealing music the way they used to. That's right, with the shutdown of LimeWire, the main source for peer-to-peer music file sharing, person-to-person music file sharing is at an all-time low. I don't think we said file sharing enough in that sentence. Yep, you can't even give it away. Or, to be more exact, people aren't even willing to steal it anymore. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's kind of a sad commentary on things. I'm not sure what's happening or what's causing that. Is it maybe just the lack of access to LimeWire?
I think maybe lots of people are lazy and they haven't gone out searching for a new client yet.
So if somebody takes over LimeWire's space, you would expect it to go back up?
Yeah, it'll go back up eventually. Plus everybody's kind of stolen everything anyway. All the back catalog stuff has already been stolen. This is not a spoof. It is not a scene from Robert Altman's The Player or a skit on Saturday Night Live. Disney is, quote-unquote, rebooting the classic detective Miss Marple for what they plan on becoming a franchise. The twist? Miss Marple will be played by Jennifer Garner. Yes, Disney loves the idea of the little old lady in a small village in England solving crimes, as long as she's actually young and sexy and looks like Jennifer Garner. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Sorry. I could not stop laughing after I read this story. It literally seems like an April Fool's Day joke. And I could have sworn it was, but it came out before then. It is so insanely ridiculous. In fact, I think she's even supposed to be American. I think that's part of the idea, too. The idea of taking Miss Marple and making her a young, hot babe is so insanely dumb. It literally does sound like a joke, a spoof of what Hollywood would do. I mean, they're remaking Time Bandits, which is bizarre. They have Russell Brand redoing Arthur. They have this moronic idea of doing Miss Marple, but avoiding all the Miss Marple stuff. I mean, it's literally people who love mysteries and actually like Miss Marple, you tell them this and they literally can't stop laughing or they're very angry.
Either way.
Yeah, I think next we should have Justin Bieber playing Charlie Chan. You know, why not?
Oh my God.
I mean, it's so ridiculous, but anyway.
James Franco, actor, sex symbol, student, and now teacher. Yes, James Franco has been studying literature and writing at NYU, and now he's going to be teaching a third-year graduate class on directing. It focuses on adapting poetry into short films, a rather specialized genre he has some familiarity with since Franco has turned a series of poems into short films that have played festivals around the world. Big deal or big whoop, Michael? I'm almost falling asleep reading the thing.
It's a big whoop unless you're one of the 12 students who gets to take his class. He's an interesting, smart guy. It could be fun.
Did you hear his, not excuse, but explanation of his low...
He had low sugar levels or something? What was
low energy? Well, he basically said, look, you know, Anne Hathaway has so much energy, she could make the Tasmanian devil look stoned. And this was on David Letterman, and Letterman said, let me give you a little bit of advice here about once you host an Academy Awards that nobody likes.
Because I have experience.
Yeah. Here are the stages of grief. Could Ashton Kutcher get punked by Ed Asner? That's the premise behind a new prank reality series at NBC. They've picked up Betty White's Off Their Rockers, a candid camera-style show in which senior citizens will punk unsuspecting younger people. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, it's a big whoop. Here's the show that's going to turn around NBC's fortunes.
Dr. Zeus has got a new book. We really think it's worth a look. Most of the tales are new to you, printed once and then lost to view. The Bipolo Seed and Tad and Todd are just two of the stories by this picture book god. It comes out in September, delivered with pride, bursting with treasures like the great Henry McBride. So look for it then, folks, and lay down the bucks, or your little children will think you're all schmucks. Now, Michael, I ask you, and please keep it real, is this a big whoop or is this a big deal?
I think it's a big whoop. It's a series of Dr. Seuss short stories written for magazines and other periodicals that appeared over the years and are finally getting collected in book form. I don't think there are any gems here, but it's fun to have it all out available again to people. And hardcore fans will be excited. But it's sort of marginalia, I think. But I'm sure there's one or two really good ones in there.
Marginalia. I love that phrase.
Thank you.
Actually, the classic, I think, may have been this little verse that you wrote up for Big Deal or Big Whoop.
Thank you for giving me credit.
Unfortunately, we don't have any verses for Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. But this week, I don't know. I mean, certainly people in Hollywood care about it, but I'm sure some of the folks out there who watch movies and love movies care about it as well. And that is this whole issue of the theatrical movie window.
And to put it in layman's terms, when will movies be available for video on demand? They're in a theater. How long before you can sit in your
home? I should set up the whole scene, really.
All right, please do.
Okay, so CinemaCon, this huge convention that takes place in Las Vegas every year, at Caesar's Palace, is a whole week long. And it's a convention of movie theater owners and distributors getting together and having meetings and concession manufacturers and equipment vendors. It's all about movie theaters. And
so you were like a pig in mud.
Pretty much. They wouldn't let me bring the mud in. If they would have, I certainly would have been bathing in it like a pig.
What were some of the highlights?
Some of the highlights were some studio executive said that Chinese box office will surpass the U.S. box office in 10 years. And I kind of said, okay, yeah, kind of like they surpassed the U.S. population. I mean, but
they're not even close to enough theaters, are they?
They are on a building binge.
But I mean, does he mean revenue or ticket sales?
Revenue.
Really? Because they have three times the population, obviously. But I'm not sure if that seems a little fast to me, that they would make enough revenue to triple the U.S. box office and make $10 billion a year at the box office in China, or probably $12 billion at that point. Does that seem a little optimistic to you?
No, it seems about right.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Here's a newsflash. Piracy is the biggest threat to the movie industry, or so says Chris Dodd, the new chairman of the MPAA. Also, theater owners are experimenting with social media as a way to market and keep in touch with their patrons.
Oh, God. I remember seeing a local theater in Champaign, Illinois saying, "Follow us on Twitter," to which I thought, why? Why would I want to follow you on Twitter?
James Cameron was there, along with Jeffrey Katzenberg and George Lucas. Cameron said he's going to shoot Avatar 2 and 3 at higher frame rates, probably 48 frames or 60 frames per second.
What does this mean?
It's quite interesting. He did a whole demo there at CinemaCon where he showed, he shot footage, which was 3D, and he shot it at 24, 48, and 60. And really, 48 and 60 frames looks so much better than 24.
Do you need a different way of displaying these images?
Well, you need digital. I mean, the problem with trying to do 48 or 60 frames with film is that you're limited to how fast a frame of film can move through a projector gate. So, you know, with digital, it's, you know, there's no moving parts. It's a lot easier.
Does this seem like the wave of the future for everybody?
I think that if Cameron does it and it works well, it will wind up being something that everybody uses.
Well, no, because he's done 3D, and that doesn't mean 3D is going to become a standard for every type of movie.
No, but this is easy enough to do, that you can always, you know, downshift to 24 afterwards in post. So
why would you want to?
For television and for home video.
It just gives you a hyper-realistic look? Is that the basic idea?
Yeah, I mean, there's no stutter, there's no blur on pans and dollies. It's pretty amazing.
And some people used to say that the flicker of the images was part of the dreamlike effect and beauty of film. Is that just absurd?
No, it is, I think. But now it's more of an effect. Kind of like now on a CD, you hear record scratching. You know, it's like,
but that's sort of a quaint thing you only see once in a great while.
Right.
But,
and that's what I'm saying. It's like, that's kind of what you're going to see is okay. Anyway. But, you know, Cameron, Jeffrey Katzenberg and George Lucas, they attended a lunch and they said that the best place to watch a movie, get this, guess where they said it, the best place to watch a movie is?
My bedroom. In a car, in a portable DVD player in the back seat, on an iPad in an airplane.
These were all, I think they came in second, third and fourth, but in a movie theater. Ironically,
they're right.
So here you have all of these exhibitors and these theater owners meeting with distributors, and they're all in one place getting along for an entire week. Then on Thursday morning, the Hollywood Reporter reports that
drop a bombshell.
Yeah, they dropped a huge bombshell that Warner Brothers, Fox, Sony, and Universal have cut deals with DirecTV to offer theatrical films just 2 months, 60 days after they hit theaters. And deals with Comcast and Vudu, which are, you know, one's a cable network and one's a streaming video service, they're also in the works and almost done. The movies will be sold for $30 per rental. And theater owners, of course, they loved this idea. They thought it was so great. They that you should have seen the – it was a pretty interesting Thursday. Let's put it that way.
Well, why haven't they made deals with like Time Warner and all the other big cable companies?
I'm sure it's just a matter of time.
It is?
Yeah, it's just
so
a matter of time.
So basically anybody, anywhere will be able to do this.
Right. And, you know, there was some talk about, well, why on God's green earth would the studios announce this during CinemaCon on the last day? Well, frankly, they didn't. It was either a studio that is not participating in this plan, this premium VOD plan, as it's called, which Paramount has been against this from the very beginning, mainly because one of their owners, Sumner Redstone, owns National Amusements, one of the North America's largest theater chains, so he really doesn't like this idea, or it was DirecTV leaking it. But, you know, one of those groups leaked it, and it kind of made NATO look really bad and the studios look really bad.
Well, why didn't make them look bad?
Well, because they're doing it at a time
they
when...
They spoiled their week. They should have told them next week.
Well, the plan had been to announce the news on April 14th, from what I've been told.
Mm-hmm.
And so it leaked early at a time when it just kind of ends the show on a sour note.
So theater owners are furious. Why? What does this mean? What's the window right now? When you see a movie in a theater, how long is it typically before you can rent a movie on demand? And, you know, go to your cable channel and say, I want to see Source Code. How long will you normally have to wait?
Usually about 4 months and between 4 and 6 days. So like, you know, about 4 months, 1 week.
So typically a movie comes in a theater. 3 months later, you can probably buy it on DVD. Another month.
No, 4 months later. 4 months later.
On DVD, I'm talking about. DVDs
yes.
are often 3 to 4 months too. Are video on demand and DVD hand in hand?
No, video on demand, I believe, is 28 days after release.
Right. Okay, so it comes out in theaters. 3 months later, or 3 to 4 months later, you can see it on DVD.
And it's 4 months later is DVD release. So 4 months later is DVD. 5 months later is VOD. So
right. And if a movie works really well, they delay. Like, The King's Speech didn't come out 3 months after it hit theaters because it was a platform release and it ran for quite a while. Same thing with Avatar and other movies. So they always maintain a flexibility. It's not like they have to release it within 120 days or 90 days or 60 days. They just have the option.
Right. But if you don't know, if you're a theater owner and you're basically given an exclusive product, which may be exclusive or may not be exclusive, depending on how, you know, whatever the studio feels like, what the exhibitors, the theater owners are saying is, look, you did what you thought was necessary for your business. We'll do what we think is necessary. Because around that 60-day mark, film rental drops to 35%, meaning that the theater owners only have to pay 35% of whatever a film grosses to the studio.
They keep more of the money.
Yeah,
longer a movie runs in a theater, the more money the theater owner makes.
Right, so they're saying a couple things. One, we'll just move those terms up. In other words, you're going to be pounded on film rental terms. And secondly, you know, we show all of these trailers for movies. We're not going to keep doing that for free since we're showing them to a captive audience. If we're doing that so that you can advertise a film which is going to be available on VOD moments after it's available in the theater.
Why haven't they been charging to show film trailers anyway?
Because it's kind of been this tacit understanding of, you know, unwritten and unspoken that, hey, we're showing
all
these
working together.
We're all working together. We're showing these trailers to advertise your movies and bring people back to our theater to watch them. But now it's, we're advertising your movies and, well, they may not come back to our theater to watch them. And that's really the hiccup, is if you know that you can see a movie 60 days out, you may wait and not go to the movie theater. It's the mindset of the theater goer or potential theater goer that, if changed, might damage theaters.
And we know it works with DVD. People say, I'll wait for DVD on that.
Right. And that's a 4-month wait. Now they're saying, no, it'll only be 2 months.
Right. To watch a movie on video on demand. But again, they're charging $30. So this is sort of a premium service. So someone's not going to sit at home alone and say, I won't go see it in the theater for $8 because I can pay 30 in a week.
Right. But you might invite 4 of your friends over.
Yeah. But, you know, video on demand is not always a massive group effort.
No, but what I'm saying is, you know, for a family of 4 to see Tangled, granted, that was in 3D, so maybe a bad example, but Rango, which was not...
Say Hop,
not in 3D. Family of 4, you got 2 parents, there's $24 right there.
Yeah, we know it costs a lot to go to the movies. We know if you got 4 or 5 people, it can be cost the same as if you bought a ticket to the theater.
Right.
Well, I mean, are theater owners overreacting? Because it is a changing world, and we all thought the world would end if... DVDs used to come out, or VHS, a year after a movie was released in theaters. You know,
they're overreacting to a point, but I also think they have a point, and that is, you know, it's really been the studio's game to call all of these. You know, for decades it's been the studio's racket, and exhibitors just had to go along with it. And I think now exhibitors really need to step up and say, we are a distribution channel. This is the way you get your content, your product, out into the world. It is one distribution channel. And we're going to start negotiating harder terms.
Do you think the terms have been too soft?
Well, they haven't had a choice, really.
But why do the theaters have more leverage now that the studios have yet another way of getting a revenue stream?
Well, they don't really. Ultimately, they're going to have to still play content. And until some folks show up with different types of content, or, you know, alternative forms of content that isn't studio related, they really have to rely on the studios for their product. But like Walmart, or like a Costco, or like, you know, any store, any distribution channel, you can now negotiate a little bit harder for for the price of that product, the wholesale price of that product, especially if you don't have any exclusivity to it.
Yeah. So you're like, hey, we're really mad at you, and you're going to play hardball with us, so we're going to play hardball with you. We want more, a bigger cut of the revenue. We want this. We want that. But are they going to be able to push back and get the studios to relent on this 60-day window? No.
I highly doubt it.
I don't think it'll be a very big revenue stream. $30, 60 days in, big deal. You know, it's going to come out another few weeks on DVD. You can own it for less than that. What the hell would you pay for it?
Yeah, good question.
But it's another little twist. It's another little thing. Why not offer it? But I don't know that it's, you know, I think video on demand makes a lot of sense for indie films that aren't going to play most of the country. For big studio films, it just doesn't make any sense to me. All you can do is undercut yourself by having 10 people show up at a home and watch it.
Right.
But I did go back and say, well, I wonder how many movies are in theaters 8 weeks into their run, because that's the big argument the studios make. They say, hey, most movies make most of their money in the first 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. But, you know, it's actually a pretty good list of movies that were in the top 10 well into their run. The King's Speech, True Grit, Black Swan, The Fighter, Tangled, Inception, Toy Story 3, Iron Man 2, How to Train Your Dragon, Avatar, Crazy Heart, Lovely Bones, The Blind Side, Up in the Air.
So these are all movies that were in the top 10, still, you know, making some serious bucks 8 weeks out.
Right. I mean, some of them, King's Speech was in the top 10 16 weeks out. Avatar was in the top 10 15 weeks out. And obviously those are the movies where they'll say, hey, we should delay before we launch it on video on demand because it's still making big bucks.
That's exactly what Jim Giannopoulos over at Fox said. He said, and this is a quote from the New York Times, who spoke to him on Sunday, the longer they're in theaters... meaning the longer the movies are in theaters, the longer the window, which might become the rule. So that's a way of kind of telling the theater owners, hey, if you keep the film booked in your theaters, we won't be doing a premium VOD for this title.
Right. He's saying if Inception has legs and you know, we're not going to undercut it by doing this thing. But on the other hand, as theater owners say, if people know to expect it, then they might be less likely to go to the theater.
Yes, it's all about the mindset of the cinema goer. If they believe they can see a certain movie in 60 days on VOD and are interested in that, then they get out of the habit of going to the theater.
Just like a lot of people say, that's DVD-able.
Right.
Outlay for the DVD. They do it all the time. So it's a very real concern. It's just something you got to keep in mind.
And now they're saying, you know, we'll wait for the stream or we'll wait for the download.
The download of Showbiz Sandbox.
Right. You did have to wait 2 weeks. And again, the reason we didn't have a guest today is we had so much news to go over that a guest would have just gotten in our way. However, we'll go back to our normal routine next week. We'll get a guest or two. Of course, you can always subscribe and download our podcast at iTunes or in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, if that's still open. I guess it is still open, right?
Yep.
Or, you know, you can use an RSS reader as well. You can find those links, as well as links to all of our social networking accounts and links to all of the stories we've discussed in today's episode, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's toll-free, 888-567-7263. Now, the music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, believe it or not, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com, or on the Huffington Post from time to time. He's also on Twitter. The username to look up is @michaelgiltz. I'm on Twitter, where my username is @sperling, and some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.